that iconic music you see, The Dawn of Mankind, in Stanley Kubrick's classic 2001 A Space Odyssey. And that's by way of introducing you to William von Hippel. He's the author of a book called The Social Leap that tells the story of our psychological evolution, of how and why as humans we need to connect. William von Hippel is also Professor of Psychology at the University of Queensland, although joining us from his native USA, he's in New York right now. G'day, Bill.
Hi.
So what is the social leap?
So the social leap is the term I use for the leap that our ancestors made from the rainforest to the savannah. It's a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that the leap itself took a few million years, so it wasn't exactly a leap. And the rainforest
Not one small leap, one very long leap.
No, not very speedy. And it was really the case that the rainforest left us more than we left it. But nonetheless, what made us successful on the savannah was us gathering together to cooperate much more effectively than we ever had in the past. Our chimpish ancestors weren't so good at cooperating, but what made us a success was our capacity to band together in service of collective action in an effort to protect ourselves from these predators that we just didn't have to deal with before.
Yeah, all right. So human survival is about the ability to get along and work as a team and strength in numbers. But Bill, lots of animals live together in groups for their survival and protection. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, you can imagine a couple of wildebeest running along next to each other in a herd of 10,000 and probably have no idea who each other are. It's the interdependence of our groups that made all the difference. And so chimpanzees are interdependent, much more so than, for example, wildebeest are. But they don't cooperate very well. They don't work together very well. Their fundamental orientation is competitive with each other. One of the easiest ways to see that is if you actually look at their eyes. They have brown all the way around their eyes, which is their way of disguising the direction of their attention.
Oh, how fascinating.
We evolved these white sclera to our eyes that advertise where we're looking. And what that tells you is that our ancestors wanted others to know what they were thinking because those others were probably going to help them rather than hurt them.
I have never thought about it or heard it described in that way. That's fascinating. One of the things that we developed in this need to get along with others also is self-control. How mm-hmm. is self-control essential to survival?
Well, you know, sometimes we berate ourselves for our poor self-control, but in reality, our self-control is much better than the other animals. And we've got a couple of key brain regions that allow that. The lateral prefrontal cortex, for example, a big piece of turf along the front of your head, it puts the brakes on those drives that you might otherwise express. So you've got these sort of underlying urges for positive things like food or sex, and urge for these negative things like aggression. And what makes us so effective is the fact that we can put the brakes on those urges and say to ourselves, well, it's not the time or place. I've got to plot my strategy more carefully, that sort of thing. That self-control that we nowadays use, you know, to sit in class and listen to boring lectures, to sit through boring meetings, our ancestors didn't do that. They really just used that self-control for social purposes.
Tell me more. Tell me more about how that developed and why.
Sure. So if you look at chimpanzees, they can engage in a little bit of self-control when they're really scared, but they can't delay themselves. They can't put off things that they really want. One of my favorite studies that shows how well we put off things that we really want was conducted by Walter Mischel here in New York City, actually, well, and in San Francisco quite some time ago. And what he found is that he brought children into the lab, small ones.
Oh, this is the famous marshmallow test.
Yeah. And so little children have very poorly developed frontal lobes, and so their self-control isn't very good. But he told them, look, if you can hold out until I return, you can have twice as many of these marshmallows. And what made the kids effective was, you know, here they can't do what we can do, which is just stare the marshmallow down and not eat it. For them to look at
well,
it was to
Well, you might be
you know,
able to. I'm not sure
up.
I can still.
Well, not all of us are good all the time. But what they could do was they could strategize. So they'd turn their back on it. They'd sing themselves songs. They would try to play games to distract themselves. And this is one of the many ways that we've evolved the capacity to sort of know ourselves better and to try to engage in behaviors that are in our long-term best interest. Now, obviously, all of us fail lots of time. We look at the cake in the fridge and say, I really shouldn't eat that. It's inconsistent with my goals of exercise or fitness. And then we eat it anyway. But nonetheless, we succeed far more often than we give ourselves credit for.
Mm. All right. Well, what about some other emotions that are sort of described as social emotions, things like pride and guilt and shame. I think you term them the self-conscious emotions.
That's right. So those came along for the ride in a very important way. So remember, if we evolve these capacities for self-control in order to get along better with each other, in order to not cause fights with our group, in order to not flirt with the girl when the big guy's around, in order to be more socially successful, the one way to make that work really well is for us to understand how other people feel about us. And so in contrast to the other animals, we've evolved this capacity to reflect on their impressions of us, and we actually then feel those emotions ourself. When we do something good, we feel pride and our value in our group has been elevated and we feel a positive response. If we do something embarrassing or shameful, humiliating, we feel shame or guilt and our sense of self has been devalued and we vow to ourselves not to do those kinds of things again. So lots of people look at them as, especially emotions like shame and guilt, as negative things, but of course they're mission critical for our evolution and even our own development as humans. Just because we need to know how others feel about us and anticipate that and then avoid those behaviors,
those negative ones. I've always found guilt and shame to be very motivating.
Yeah, exactly. Super motivating.
What about, though, the developing the ability to lie? I mean, how did that help us become fully human?
Yeah, so lying is a funny one. If you look at lots of animals, they engage in deception, but their deceptions actually only involve them just acting a certain way and, disguising themselves, hoping not to be noticed, pretending to be poisonous.
Camouflage, having the ability to camouflage,
exactly.
That sort of thing, yeah.
Exactly. That doesn't require that the animal understand what another animal's thinking. It just needs to do a strategy that's been successful. For humans to lie, though, what we do, we're the only ones who can do this. And what we do is we intentionally plant false beliefs in other people's minds. And in order to do that, we have to cross this threshold where we understand for the first time that the contents of your mind are not identical to the contents of mine. Now, that seems so obvious to us as an adult, but children don't have that. Mm. Until about the age of 4, they can't understand that all minds don't share the same contents.
And that is kind of a giant leap, isn't it?
It's a huge leap, and it's part of the reason why they'll often make these pronouncements that are impossible to follow, because they just assume that you've been thinking what they've been thinking. And so the moment the kids develop the ability to understand that other people don't think what they're thinking, they say, wow, I could plant ideas in your head that'll benefit me that aren't true. And that's the birth of lying.
Why then, though, do we have the capacity also to kind of believe our own lies, self-deception? What function does that serve?
Yeah, that seems like a weird one because, if you're going to tell a lie and the other person believes it, great, because now you've just gained something without earning it. But telling yourself a lie and then believing it seems like it only would have downside. But this is actually an insight that my colleague Robert Trivers had about 40 years ago, where he pointed out that self-deception might actually evolve because it would make us more effective at deceiving others. There's lots of examples of that, but I think the easiest one is overconfidence. If I go through life believing that I'm Bill plus 20%, let's say, then you're going to give me more credence than I'm due. You're going to defer to me in conflict. You're going to go out with me when you shouldn't because you could do a lot better than me. In all sorts of ways, my self-deception could get me in trouble, and so there's a cost, but it gets me big benefits if I can get the world to see me in a way that's more beneficial to me.
So it's a kind of exaggerating of self.
It could be exaggerating. It could be like literally, if you watch me eat the last dessert, well, I can't say, no, I didn't do that because you just saw me. But what I can do is say, oh, I thought you'd already eaten dessert. I can recast my behavior to look like it's more polite in that context. I can change my motive. I can say, look, I was trying to be thoughtful, but I was just unaware. And if I believe it myself, then I've got a better shot at convincing you. And we talk ourselves into these things. We get outraged when other people don't believe us, even when we're not telling the truth.
My guest here in Life Matters is William von Hippel. He's the author of The Social Leap, all about the role that evolution has played in shaping our psychology, our social functioning. Now, Bill, as social creatures, one thing that we do a lot is talk about each other, gossip. Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a great term for this, reputation broadcasting. Why do we gossip? How does it help and how's it evolved over time?
Well, we make fun of gossip. We act like it's a trivial thing that other people do. But in reality, we all enjoy it. There's not a human being on the planet that doesn't enjoy a juicy tale about their neighbors. And so the question is why? Why would we evolve to enjoy this so much? And I think the answer to that question is that gossip keeps people in line. So, you know, think about the hunter-gatherer groups that we evolved in, that we lived in until just 10 or 12,000 years ago. Those groups were very small. People were interdependent on each other. And if one person starts throwing their weight around, they're really a risk to everybody else. And so gossip is a very easy way for me to tell you the ways that I've been taken advantage of by person X in our group. And then you can get outraged along with me. You can tell your friends. And pretty soon, person X is in trouble because all of us have ganged up against them.
Now, in the age of social media, I suppose reputation broadcasting, gossiping, takes on a somewhat different cast.
Yeah, I think gossip worked really well when we all knew each other. So if somebody's misbehaving in our group, we gossip about them. They would know that, they would realize that stories are being told, and they line, get their behavior back in line. The problem is that we now have those same mechanisms, you know, social media, but they're often being engaged in by people who don't know you at all. Mm. So, you know, you do something kind of trivial that's wrong. You maybe tweet a stupid joke, or you do something else on Facebook, and suddenly the whole world is jumping on you because they're, you know, they might be justly upset about what you've done, but they don't know that you're actually a perfectly good person in all these other ways. And so social media has interestingly brought us back to the world of our ancestors, where everybody was in everybody's business all the time, but it's done so in this potentially costly way where it's not tempered by people's positive knowledge of you, their experiences that they've had with you, you know, probably across their entire lives.
Mm. Let's talk about happiness and the elusive nature of happiness. Like, you know, you accomplish something significant for you, you achieve, you know, a long-held goal, something like that. But the deep happiness that you derive from these sorts of things can be somewhat fleeting. Why is that?
Yeah, happiness is kind of a raw deal. It's a great thing to have, but if you think about why it would evolve, you realize that evolution can't give us permanent happiness. It can give us sort of a semi-positive feeling at most times, which is good, gets you out of bed in the morning, gets you off to work. But if it made you permanently really happy, well, then why would you ever be motivated to achieve anything? And so what evolution did instead is it played this kind of dirty trick on us. It gives us happiness a little bit. It gives us the thoughts of great happiness when we achieve our goals. And then when we work really hard to achieve our goals, we actually do get that experience of happiness. But then evolution ensures that it's kind of fleeting. And depending on what it is we achieved, a day, maybe a few days, maybe a week at most later, we've gone right back to our new baseline. And so we think, boy, if I could just get that raise, if I could buy that vacation home, if I could do that, whatever, I would be happy forever. But that's literally never going to happen. You can't be happy forever because any ancestors who could be happy forever were pretty quickly left behind by those ancestors who were much more hungry to achieve.
So in other words, evolution shaped us to be successful, not to be happy.
Yeah, that's right.
Rather
than
happy.
Sad truth,
yeah.
That's right. The sad truth is that evolution doesn't really care if we're happy. It cares if we're reproductively successful. And if I, you know, imagine that I wrote that really good paper in year 7 and I thought I'd be forever happy. Well, I don't bother going on to year 8, 9 or graduating. You know, I'm going to be left behind. None of the girls in the group are going to choose me. I won't have any offspring. And so my capacity for permanent happiness when I wrote a good term paper in year 7, it's going to die with me.
Well, now, look, the traits we've been talking about, you know, however contradictory they might be, evolved, I guess, to make us work harmoniously together. That's what you've been saying, for the greater good, really. But in modern Western societies, we do tend to focus on individual happiness, don't we, rather than a sort of collective happiness. Does that mean there's a clash? Are any of those behaviours that we've been talking about kind of no longer relevant or holding us back?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, unfortunately, these things are in tension with each other. And so on the one hand, as in modern Western countries like ours, we have this notions of autonomy and we should get to pick our own path in life. And that's super important. But we also have notions of connectedness and of collectivism and wanting to do good for our group and our family and our friends. And that kind of connection actually sits in opposition to autonomy. If I'm completely autonomous and ignore others, I've lost my connection. But if I'm totally focused on connection, I forget about my own path and the freedoms that I have to do the things that I might personally want to do. And so the unfortunate truth is that we have to live our lives with this tension permanently, and each of us tries to find the point at which we're happiest. So how much am I a person who values connection? How much am I a person who values autonomy? And the reality is that we all move a bit toward autonomy in young adulthood, and then when we get there, we say, that connection was pretty good, and we move back toward connection typically.
Well, another interesting contradiction in human behaviour that you talk about too is social comparison. So that's where, say, you genuinely enjoy seeing a friend of yours succeed. You really do take pleasure in that. But it's also possible at the same time to feel jealous of them. Is the success of another person, someone you know, somehow threatening in an evolutionary sense? How do you account for that sort of contradiction?
Unfortunately, it is threatening. So sexual selection is one of the mechanisms that Darwin first proposed, is the idea that we evolved also to try to be chosen by members of the other sex so that we can successfully reproduce. And so things that the other sex want are valuable in us. And we try to have those things. But the key here is that everything is relative. If I'm a completely worthless schmuck, but everyone in my group is even more worthless and nastier and annoying than I am, well, I'm still going to get chosen as a mate because I'm literally the best she can do, even though I'm not very good. On the other hand, if I'm wonderful, but my group is even more wonderful than I am, I'll never get chosen. So in the end, our absolute traits aren't as important as our relative traits, how we stand out compared to others. The unfortunate consequence of that is it makes us constantly worried about what other people have, what other people are getting, how we stack up against them. This is probably more debilitating to human happiness than anything else, but it makes sense in an ancestral environment where inside this small group, I need to stand out in some way. Maybe I'm the best hunter. Maybe I'm the friendliest. Maybe I'm the best storyteller. The problem is in our modern world, it's literally impossible to permanently stand out against all those other humans that we can compare ourselves against. And so it puts us on this kind of hedonic treadmill where we're constantly trying to outachieve people around us. And worse yet, as you pointed out, it makes us jealous of our friends. When they achieve something and we should just be happy for them, we are happy, but we simultaneously suddenly feel a little bit devalued because suddenly they're a better choice than they were before, and we're not as good of a choice. Now, little of that is conscious, but that's the underlying psychology that drives that bus.
Well, Bill, with all these sort of evolved behaviours and traits that we've been talking about, why is it useful to understand this stuff, do you reckon?
Yeah, it's a good question. So on the one hand, for me, I'm always just fascinated by why we are the way we are. So how can we understand ourselves better? In my own case, I'm really interested in social intelligence, what makes us socially skilled. And when we struggled with that problem for a long time, almost 100 years now, and we've made very little progress. And so it occurred to me that maybe we could make more progress if we get a better picture of where we were and what some of the big changes were along the way. Maybe we can understand the way we are today better. So lots of the ways we are today make perfect sense and they're a good match with our environment. But when you consider our evolutionary history, you start to realize there's some mismatches there. Evolving in small groups the way we did, with set groups of people that were always the same, didn't really prepare us to live in big cities with worlds of strangers. So factors that can really disrupt our happiness that weren't relevant for our ancestors play a big role today. Factors that make us socially skilled, etc. So I think it's helpful to understand our past because it gives us a little bit of purchase on our present.
Yes, and I wonder about our future, I suppose. What will we become? How will we evolve psychologically? I guess that's something that's hard to predict, but you've given us a picture of where we've come from and where we are at the moment, Bill. The Social Leap is the name of the book by William von Hippel. It's an evolutionary argument for how and why humans interact in the way that we do in all our complexity and contradictions. Bill is also Professor of Psychology at Queensland University, though joining us from New York City today. A great pleasure to speak with you, Bill. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Life Matters.